Welcome to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend.
Hi, Tim.
Hey, Gil. How's Trix?
Good. Now, today we have a guest with us again, which is really exciting. So we've got Clarissa Raywood joining us. Hi, Clarissa.
Hello. Thank you both for having me on your show.
We're so excited to have you. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, and we're all in really far-flung destinations today. So you're in Brisbane, I think, Clarissa. I'm in Newcastle and Tim's in Canberra. So it's so nice to be able to join up on a podcast and be able to talk to each other, like regardless of our location.
It's so cool podcasting, isn't it, in that sense. I, as you know, run my own show, and this last 12 months, thanks to COVID, had to use Zencastr like you do to interview people. And I love that you can talk to people in America, in the UK, and it's sort of like you're in the same place. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's amazing. So I just thought we might start by introducing you, because you actually have a pretty impressive resume and set of skills. So Tim, I'm going to talk to you in doing this. So Clarissa is known as the happy family lawyer, and we're going to circle back to that in our discussion today, because as family lawyers as well, I feel that's a bit of a hard title to maintain in the lead up to Christmas. But you can tell us how we do that. Clarissa is also an accredited specialist in family law and a mediator and the director of the Brisbane Family Law Centre. She's written two books that we know about. And I have to say, Clarissa, look, I have one here in the Newcastle office. She wrote Splitsville, How to Separate, Stay Out of Court and Stay Friends. And I like this because it looks nice and decorative on the shelf here. So it's lots of colour. And you wrote the book Happy Lawyer, Happy Life. And Clarissa's also a podcaster and blogger and runs courses and events to support career wellbeing and development, such as the 7-Day Happiness Challenge, the Club and the Retreat, which I think you've just had like in the last month or so. So welcome.
Thank you.
I guess in terms of starting on our discussion today, because look, our podcast is really about talking in regards to family law and, you know, family law issues, because that's what we're passionate about. And having a look at your website and all the glorious colour that's on that as well, one of the things that you indicate is that your practice has a real focus on resolving matters without going to court. And we're all about that as well, although, I mean, we do darken the doorsteps of court when we're required. So do you want to tell us, you know, as family lawyers as well, what are the kinds of tools and practices that you engage in that get you really excited about that resolution process for clients?
I think naturally I was never best suited to the adversarial model that sits within litigation. And that's what led me to be really interested in other ways of solving problems for people when their relationships were coming to an end. Really early in my career, I was blessed to hear one of our judges up here speak after she'd taken a bit of a sabbatical, gone to Canada, and learned about collaborative practice. And I must have been in my 20s sitting in the audience, and I just listened to her and I thought, gosh, that just makes so much sense. People sitting down, working out what their differences are, identifying what those things are, working out what the future might look like for each of them based upon their beliefs, their values, the things that matter to them in life, not what an arbitrary piece of legislation tells them should matter to them in life. And it just resonated with me. And so that, I guess, interest-based negotiation, that anyone that's done mediation training, that real values-based practice, really understanding who is this person and what matters to them, is the piece that drives how I work as a lawyer and that sits under everything I do. I, like you, still go to court. I'm an ICL. I was just talking to you both before we started recording about that. I do a huge amount of work as an independent children's lawyer and also a separate representative in the children's court. And court has its place. I don't want anyone to ever think it's not a place to be. There are absolutely families that are best supported in the court process. But there's also a whole bunch of families that I think can be best supported outside of that process. And for us as family lawyers, the creativity for me comes from solving problems. And you have so many more options with that creativity when you're not bound by here's the legal framework and we must stick within it because we're in a court process. When we step outside of the court process, we just have more options. And I think that's the piece that really interests me.
And I think just going back to that, I mean, look, Tim and I don't do a lot of collaborative law in our practice group. Certainly I've done the collaborative practice training and, you know, it is really interesting even just to improve your skill set about trying to work out solutions for clients. But even outside of that sphere, you know, sitting down with clients and, you know, these are the matters which don't involve the really tricky stuff that might be beyond, you know, being creative in a broad brush sense, but sitting down with clients and actually asking them what they hope to achieve rather than telling them what they're going to get can be such an amazing tool at the start of a matter. Like, and I think, you know, it's certainly, you know, something that we try and embody in our practice because you're right, it just makes, you know, it gives you so many more options when you understand what people want individually rather than what we might expect they want from the process.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. When you lead with what matters to the person that you're working with as opposed to what matters to the legal system and therefore telling them what the answer will be, it just shifts the conversation entirely. And what they want might be entirely unachievable in the realms of the legal process. But I would like to know that, and I'd like to know that early on so that I can then go, okay, this may be more challenging. Or maybe the other person has entirely similar, albeit strange, views about the end game, and who am I to tamper with that? That's their life and their life choices.
Yeah. And look, I mean, in terms of that, you know, what I guess Tim and I are also quite interested in kind of talking to people from other practice groups and registries, because we primarily practice out of like the Canberra and Sydney and Newcastle registries. But he's seeing how other people are doing it in other registries. So obviously we've had a lot of changes in our court system recently. And I don't know about you, maybe you're all over it. We are still definitely getting to grips with some of the changes. But have you seen any kind of new approaches come out of your registry in particular in terms of how people are trying to resolve matters in the face of, you know, the litigation restructuring that we've had?
I think Brisbane, prior to the changes, was already quite unique in how things worked. We had already had here in Brisbane for a number of years a real focus on mediation prior to filing in financial matters as much as in parenting matters.
Yeah.
And our judicial officers had a process in financial matters particularly where you would commence proceedings and they would be kindly encouraging and ordering people off to a mediation process. And it was just, it just was. And so for someone like me that ran a firm that is all about out-of-court dispute resolution, the court was actually my best tool, because if someone wasn't going to work with us to try and get to, say, mediation, I would commence proceedings to get the order to go to mediation.
Yeah.
So the structural changes that we've seen come out post-September, I don't think have been a massive shift for many of us here in Brisbane. But some of the things that I have enjoyed has been the opportunity now to really formally say this matter would benefit from dispute resolution, Your Honour. And, you know, we would invite you to make that order. And particularly as an ICL, I've been involved in a number of the court-run mediations by the various registrars. I find it really interesting that we've got registrars all over the country now that we're all engaging with to do these things. And they're very successful. So I haven't noticed a massive shift, but I do think the changes are positive. And I think anything that gives us more options again to be able to say, well, sometimes matters just need to file to get information, don't they, or to overcome a hurdle. And then you overcome that hurdle and now people are in a place where they can settle. And so having more of those opportunities, I think, is a really good thing for the system.
And then working through the Brisbane Registry, in terms of timelines and so on and so forth, because I know we spoke to Colin Forrest a little while and there was quite a backlog of matters that were sitting there waiting allocation for final hearing dates. Now that the changes have come in, I know that we're seeing a lot of movement in our registries. Matters are getting listed quite quickly. Things are actually really moving forward positively. Are you seeing that same change up in the Brisbane Registry?
Yes, for new matters. So if we were to file an application today, I know just from a matter I did recently, the application was filed. The first return date was actually before the 28 days that the response had to be filed.
Oh, my goodness.
I was like, this is just a bit obscure. How do we manage this? So it was, you know, the first return date was in 3.5 weeks from the date of filing. That was unheard of. However, I have a bunch of matters that were, you know, that are 2 years old, that are sitting floating in the system waiting for trial dates. So I can say my experience is that there is still a massive backlog of matters pre the change that are awaiting allocation for trial. And it's unclear to me how that's going to be managed now that we've got this fast track system for new things, but we've still got this backlog. Some point those things are going to collide. And I, you know, I've always been an advocate for more resourcing in the family law system, and I think we still need more judicial officers and more resourcing up there to try and achieve what was set with these new things, in the sense of this idea of things being finished in 12 months. That's such a sensible thing. But if the resourcing's not there, then that's just not going to be possible.
Yeah, we've, especially in the registries we practice out of, we've had some, you know, this kind of volume of an influx in terms of judicial appointments. So I know, for example, in Newcastle, we just had 2 new judges appointed who are both great. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's really heartening as well to kind of see this change, and especially with, like, you know, judicial registrar resourcing and so mm-hmm. forth, because you think we've just had so many years of that not happening. But the other thing we've found in our registries, and I think it's because they're probably smaller registries than Brisbane, is that for a long time we've had visiting judges come in to kind of take off that trial load that our judges have had, because we haven't had a lot of judicial officers. And so lots of our matters are now also still being allocated to judges outside of our registry for hearing, you know, and we're all used to Zoom and so forth. We're not Zencasting out trials yet. Who knows? But, you know, that's also been, you know, the kind of frequency of that's been really interesting as well. And it's a bit anxiety provoking because, you know, you get very comfortable with your judicial officers and think, okay, this is how my trial's going to run. But I mean, you sort of think the benefit to the client in getting this stuff happening earlier and, you know, versus our discomfort with it, I think is just part of the way of the brave new world, and it's quite exciting.
Mm. Oh, I agree. I also observed one central difference that I was unaware of between Sydney and, I imagine, Newcastle and Queensland, is in parenting matters, family reports. So in Queensland, we get family reports really early in a process.
Yeah, wow.
Like, so in essence, as soon as you file. And they're a tool that I use up here from a settlement perspective prior to filing. Get the family report before you've even done the court process, in the sense of this is going to give everyone some helpful insights as to what may or may not be happening here. And having recently had some involvement with a number of matters in Sydney, I was unaware, firstly, of the cost of private family reports. And I'm not critical of that, but $20,000 plus versus in Queensland, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000.
Yeah.
And timing in terms of obtaining them. So I do find it interesting that, albeit we have this national federal system, there are such still differences in practice and style between different parts of the country. But that, for me, has been very interesting from a parenting matters perspective. And the child impact reports that have come out now with the new system, I've observed some significant delay in getting those in Sydney versus, again, here in Queensland. Certainly originally we were getting them quite efficiently. So
yeah, that's really interesting to hear, because, I mean, it has for a long time, and especially in, you know, and you don't want to registry shame, it's certainly not the registry's fault, but, like, for example, in Canberra, it had been a really big problem because there were, you know, just really no family report writers in-house, and so people were having to get external reports, and the court would still do, you know, the old Reg 7 reports, so there'd be some people available. But if you waited for the court to give you your family report, you could be waiting, you know, a year for that to happen. And, you know, then the problem then that flows on from that is you might then get a report, but if your matter can't be heard within a certain period of time frame,
it goes stale.
And if your matter doesn't settle, yeah, it goes stale. So, I mean, it has been a significant problem in terms of the resolution of matters. And, you know, people are then encouraged, not necessarily forced, but, you know, politely encouraged to go and get these private reports. But you're right, like, it is just for some families, it's just prohibitively expensive to do so, because there's also not a lot of people who necessarily want to be experts in that capacity in our jurisdiction. So super vexed. But, you know, I guess from our perspective, I've kind of felt like these child impact reports and things have been quick. So, you know, I think it's just what we've gotten used to. But hopefully, maybe with all of the changes and so forth, it might just, you know, maybe fix itself in terms of some of these processes. But, you know, you should feel extremely lucky to have such a quick process up in Queensland. So,
yes, I'm nodding wildly and forgetting I'm on an audio show. Yes, we are very lucky.
Yeah, lots of nodding furiously. And so, I mean, the other thing, and again, this is sort of the last we'll pick your brain about registries, and it's just because it's interesting to talk to someone at length rather than your opponent about what happens. But the other thing Tim and I often talk about is the fact that our work in different registries in which we practice kind of has a different flavour as well in terms of the issues that the registry has. So one of the interesting things about Canberra and Newcastle, not so much Sydney, is I think we have a lot of relocation issues, and that's potentially because Canberra is quite a dynamic population in terms of people moving there for work, not necessarily having lived there their whole life. Newcastle, you know, it's kind of, you know, a bit of a holiday location in a sense. So people can, you know, move here or want to move back. But what do you think are the kind of big kind of challenges or types of cases that your registry sees probably more frequently than other registries?
Do you know, I don't even know the answer to that. It's just so unhelpful for you, because I don't think there is one type of case or one area of things in Brisbane. There is an army base. We're an army town as well, but not in the same way that I would perceive some of the other areas of Australia. I'm not sure that people come to Brisbane so much for the holiday location as such. They would go to the Gold Coast, but
in the dead of winter in Canberra, they totally would go to Brisbane.
Like, I would say Brisbane is where you want to live. It's not where you want to visit. It's not like a tourist town, but it's a great place to live. I don't think that, from my perspective, I don't feel like there's a category of case that ends up here. And that's what I find so interesting about practicing here, is that there isn't this is sort of commonly what we see. It is such a diverse array of what we see. And once you step out of southeast Queensland and move into broader Queensland, you encounter some fascinating communities and cultures and all sorts of things. So it is such a mixed bag, I think. Now, you had a good friend of mine, the Honourable Colin Forrest, on the show. He would have a much better idea. He was a judge in the court. So he would say, no, Clarissa, it'll be this, because that's what he did for 10 years. Yeah. That's my observation. And I do have a pretty diverse practice. So my observation, honestly, is that I don't feel like there's one type or, you know, one key area. I think it is very diverse up here.
Well, I only have one bugbear with Brisbane, is that the Brisbane Registry stole our great judge from Canberra, Amanda Tonkin, and I have a very soft spot for her because she was very, very kind to me when she was at the bar and I was a junior baby lawyer. And so that's the only grievance I can articulate about Brisbane, is that you stole Judge Tonkin.
She is a very good judicial officer, so there you go. Yes. Yes, we did. Great.
So I want to move the discussion a little bit, because we're talking about the changes in the court and what's happening in our registries, but in 2019, you were recognised by the Lawyers Weekly Australian Law Awards as the Wellness Advocate of the Year. And my kind of question for you is, how are you maintaining your own well-being as we enter the Christmas period and the family law kind of mea culpa?
Christmas crazy period.
Yeah. It's such a good question, Tim, because speaking really honestly, I've been in a really rough patch in terms of how I have felt about work and things, and I don't think I'm alone with that. The last year and a half and a bit for all of us has just been such a trick, hasn't it? And I've been in a patch of, I mentioned to you, much more litigation than I like, a very long trial that's been very taxing, just lots of hard things. And so I have not been at my best. So what do I do when I'm not at my best? And these are the tips I would give to everyone. I go back to basics. I go back to the things that I can control. So I become a sleep Nazi. Now, I'm normally a sleep Nazi anyway, but I really become a sleep Nazi for myself. So really regimented about going to bed early. I get up quite early because I've got young children, but really control that. Really focus.
Sleep hygiene is really important.
Oh, it is so, and I could talk to you for hours about the studies about that. But is if you do that, nothing else, it makes a difference.
Yeah.
Eating. So really focus when I'm in, you know, heavy periods. And I see this with lawyers. And when you're in trials, you don't eat. And you're with barristers who don't eat.
We live off the water on the bar table.
Yeah. Well, not anymore. Like, you know.
Well, you're by teams. Yeah. Well, that's true too. That's right. Bring your own water. But so, for example, I was just in a two-week trial and I pack snacks, right? So my handbag is full of muesli bars and nut bars and this and that and everything else. And the judicial officer we were before had these five-minute breaks, and that's all she did, five-minute breaks. And everyone's there dying, and I'm there with my stash of nut bars going, look at me, I'm all over this. And it sounds silly, but they're silly little things that actually make the world of difference. When you're not hungry, you can pay more attention. You feel better. But really regimented about my food and trying to make sure I'm eating really well and then trying to get some level of movement into your life and accepting that right now I don't have the space or time to run marathons, not that I could anyway. But just be realistic about that. And okay, for 10 minutes, I'm going to do this, or for 5 minutes, I'm going to do that, or I have a standing desk, I'm going to make sure so I stand at it. So just come back to the basics. When everything is chaotic and you get into that real anxiety-filled stress state, for me, I go back to what can I control? I can control my sleep. I can control my diet. I can control some level of exercise. And then just try to focus on having one nice thing to do each day, whatever that is for you. And that doesn't have to be game-changing. Like, it just, today I'm going to do this one nice thing and I'm going to feel good about that. It might be this morning I played this Demi Lovato song as I drove to work and I was like singing and dancing in the car like an idiot. And I thought if anyone saw me, they're going to think I'm crazy. But that 3 minutes completely changed my mood.
Brings you back to life.
Yeah. So just do those things. Whatever you know has the ability to shift how you feel, do it. Because this, you know, it's funny you talk about the Christmas crazy. For me, I felt like that's how the last 2 years have been for me. I have not felt like it has stopped. And that's why I think I'm reaching the end of my tether. So we've got to then go, okay, stop. I have the power to stop this. What do we do?
I think you raised a really good point there as well, is that a lot of people don't really realize that our jobs are really difficult and there is a lot of, you know, vicarious trauma and all sorts of different things that come with being a family lawyer. And interestingly, like what you just said about being in a 2 week trial, I find trials extremely fatiguing. They are such hard work. You are on all time at the whole time. You know, liaising with your barrister, you're listening to the cross, you're trying to pick up things and, you know, do your job. It's incredibly tiring.
And then if you're like me and you run a practice, you get to finish your trial at 4:30 and then do your practice that you were meant to do for that day.
Yeah.
It's huge. So we do have to be really mindful of looking after each other in those moments. And if you've got colleagues around you, if you've got someone who is just sucked into something because that's what's happened, you're supporting each other in all of those things and accepting, as you've said, Tim, that this is actually really hard. Doing this stuff is really hard. Getting consumed by other people's lives and hearing sometimes the content that we have to hear, it's troubling. Most of us are empathetic people. That's why we've chosen this area of law. And it takes a toll. When you care, it takes a toll. It's our superpower and it's our Achilles heel all at the same time.
In terms of your work and the things that you do outside, because in addition to having your busy practice, you've also got the Happy Family Lawyer and you do a whole heap of different things surrounding that. I know that you recently hosted the retreat and I know that because I saw it all over LinkedIn, but one of my very good friends, Bron O'Loan, attended. And could you tell us a little bit more about that and what that process is? Because you do a lot of that and it looks really exciting.
I think it's how I've managed to stay in the law, honestly. Is what that is. It's selfish. I run a law firm, Brisbane Family Law Centre, and now I have this other business, Happy Lawyer, Happy Life. And that whole business came from a really simple experience that I had that wasn't that awesome of not wanting to be a lawyer anymore and trying to work out what am I going to do? And I was well into my career by that point. I didn't want to leave because I'd invested so much in it. But so I had to navigate and go, well, how do I do this? How do I work in this role that creates trauma and frustrates me and makes me sad at times? And how do I do all of those things? And hence the happiness piece. The retreat that you are mentioning, Tim, is a signature event that I run each year that's connected to a membership that I run called The Club. And so your friend Bron is part of the club. There's about 150 lawyers around Australia that are part of the club, not all family lawyers. So lawyers from all different types of law and all different areas and areas of practice. And it is just the most joyful thing that I have ever created, aside from my children. So the club is, it's just a community of people that are all very much focused on building law practices that have at the heart of them this idea that you can be a happy person. And so constantly these practitioners are questioning and challenging and trying new things and doing things differently from a place of saying, how do I build a career that works for me? Not because someone else said that this is how running a law firm should be, but because this is how I want my life to be. So now in amongst my life as being a family lawyer, I have a really diverse day. So no day is the same, which would be the same for every family lawyer. No 2 days are the same. But mine will go from doing this podcast with you just in a client meeting. Tomorrow I'm running a webinar for a company about wellness. I run courses. I run retreats. And it's that diversity piece that has honestly enabled me to stay a lawyer, so that I get to go from here's something that's really hardcore that's really affected me for 2 weeks to now I get to talk to my colleagues about stuff that I am really passionate about, and that gives me energy, which enables me to keep doing what I'm doing. So that's a long answer to your question, but it's a selfish pursuit. That's the answer.
It's amazing what you're doing, but it's the thing that I think about that is what a great resource for family lawyers and other lawyers to access, because I think you're right. Like, you know, we've had, particularly Gil and I in our practice, we've had a few big weeks of really big hearings, and it gets you down. Like, you think trying to get through each day, turn up the next day, you've got to prepare for the next matter, get all your stuff done. It's kind of like, as you said, like the last 2 years particularly have been manic, and the revolving door of work and court work and meet, all of the stuff kind of ties in. Having an opportunity to reflect and look at what you can do in terms of your day-to-day practice and things that you can, you know, focus on to improve your experience at work, I think is really important.
The other thing I think is really great about that stuff, and, you know, not to sound too sucky and be like, oh, this is amazing, but, you know, when you kind of look externally at these programs and events that you run, you know, it appears to be just a really supportive environment that you're fostering. And, you know, what's nice about it is it's like encouraging people to take the space to do stuff that's still work related, but not necessarily wholly and solely focused on their day-to-day practice work. And I think, you know, certainly that's sometimes the really hard challenge of, you know, we're all here to kind of, you know, work, improve our practices and things, but, you know, finding that balance between getting through all the letters you've got to write and the documents you've got to do and seeing the clients and also finding a space to be creative is a real challenge. And I think the stuff that you do is kind of forcing people to go, hey, let's all step away and do that creatively together. And that appears to be, you know, super exciting in that regard.
I think that's right. The creativity is such an important thing to me. I am a massive crafter, maker.
My God, you should see Gil gift wrapping. Her gift wrapping. Oh my goodness.
You have to share it with me on that.
Can I say you are like, we've, you know, not that we're stalking you online or anything, but like obviously you embrace confetti like a demon. And like Tim and I probably haven't moved to confetti yet, but we are firmly in the glitter camp. Like, I think we, you know, glitz it up. But yeah, like, you know, we're setting some goals when we see what you do.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when you put into a professional environment that is all about grey, brown and being as bland as possible because we don't want to stand out, colour and creativity and, in my case, confetti. And it's just interesting to see what happens to people because they change. And that's why that business is called Happy Lawyer, Happy Life, because what I observed within myself, what I came to learn within myself, is I was trying to create lawyer Clarissa and then have a life, and the two were distinct and I was not allowing them to merge, and I needed them to merge because that's the person I am. And it was when I was trying to have these sort of two personas almost that it just didn't work. Once you let it all just be and you just are, and you're yourself. And as you said a minute ago, I just create space that encourages people to do whatever they want to do, whatever makes them happy and successful in whatever way they need. And when you surround yourself with people who are positive, who are all chasing their own version of success and not harming others, collaborating, not competing.
Yeah.
It's amazing what comes from that. So you can be having a really down day, but you see someone that you know who's just achieved something that they've been working at for 6 months, and it's like, oh, you feel a little bit of part of that success. Not that you've had anything to do with it really, but just because you're part of their community, you're like, oh, that's cool. They're doing something cool. I can still do this. And it just all helps. That energy between people I find is so helpful. And I'm a natural collaborator. I don't do things well by myself. I love working with other people. I love the ideas and thoughts of other people. And being a sole practice owner, it can be really lonely. So it's really enjoyable being around 150 other practice owners and learning from them and hearing from them and sharing those burdens. It is a really powerful thing.
I think as well, a point that you made there, which I think is extremely relevant and poignant in law practice now, is the ability to bring your whole self to work and to be who you are unashamedly. And I think that that is a trend.
Can I say that, Tim does that every day?
It's true. It's true. But I think as things change and the dynamic of the law and the practice of the law, you know, we're not sitting at desks dictating letters like they did in the 90s. There's a real shift. There has been a shift that's been happening for a while and it's still going. There are things that still need to change, but it's an exciting time to be in the law when these things are celebrated.
That's right. That's right. And I think I love the idea that we are right in the midst of that change and there are only good things to come, because the generations that we're all a part of have all just gone, no, that doesn't work for us.
Yeah, it's true.
We're going to just try it differently and see what happens. And if it doesn't work, we'll try something else.
Yeah.
And it is working.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess sort of to wrap up that, and you've sort of, you know, had these experiences with your retreat and your club, but I mean, are there any other kind of things that you see sort of out there on the horizon that you think, apart from just being themselves, lawyers really need to start doing to stay relevant and to kind of stay current in terms of their practice development?
I think the piece that will make all lawyers achieve success in terms of the life of business and law and career and all of these
things. Is it the castle?
No, it's not. It's customer experience.
Yeah.
I think if we really look at innovation and we look at the future and we look at, okay, what is it going to be a successful, in inverted commas, legal business in 10 years' time, it's all going to sit for me in customer experience. And that was not something that our profession had to worry about 20 years ago. People saw lawyers, they paid lots of money. As you said, Tim, they dictated letters, they did the thing. And I'm not suggesting lawyers weren't pleasant, but the experience wasn't high on the list of things to worry about. That has changed. We as consumers, we expect a lot. We're willing to pay a lot for things. We're also willing to pay nothing when that service piece is gone. We're willing to say, we don't care. I'll Uber it because there is no service in the taxi. The Uber man at least smiles at me and it's cheaper, so I'll go down that path. So I think for me, obviously being a great lawyer, knowing your stuff, and when I say being a great lawyer, I mean technically knowing your lawyer stuff, but the soft skills, as people like to call them, and I hate that word, the experience is the key here. Really understanding the people that you're working with, what their needs are, and meeting those needs. And most of the time in the area that we all practice in, those needs are not legal. So it's getting really clear on what is the broader issue or the broader question or the actual challenges that this person's bringing to me. And if I'm not the person that has the answers to that, who do I partner with? Who do I have in my practice that can help with that? Who else do we work with? And I think multidisciplinary practices will be much more common than they are right now.
That ties into the point at the start, which I think was really good, is that when your client first comes in, talking to them about what their expectations and needs are of the process, and as well talking about the experience and helping them through that, that knowledge from the outset also assists you to help manage their expectations, which are really important whether you're in a, you know, a alternative dispute resolution process, or particularly at court where, you know, we're in a discretionary jurisdiction and there are a range of outcomes in terms of things that can happen. Managing expectations and just what you said, the needs and what they expect, are that's one of the fundamental pillars of our role now.
Yeah.
I think there's also another kind of add-on to what you said, and this is our like kind of, you know, big love in every time we have a discussion on this podcast is, you know, Tim and I often talk about, you know, what your client leaves with post the family law experience. And, you know, I think in our jurisdiction, especially, you know, coming back to, you know, people being consumers and things, like we're a very referral-based jurisdiction, I think. I mean, I think your best clients and the best work that you can do with clients is when they have some trust in you and they've been referred. But I also think part of our kind of, you know, process needs to be ensuring that our clients leave the family law experience when it's all in a flurry to then go and manage their families without lawyers and having walked away with tools to help them resolve disputes in the future. And that's what we're really big on. Like, how can we help our clients develop tools so that when they go post litigation or post mediation, you know, they can have the discussion about how to do Christmas changeover rather than ringing us on Christmas Day. And we talked before, I always take the calls on Christmas Day. Like, some lawyers are much better than me. But, you know, I mean, do you think that's part of that whole consumer process as well and a bit of our responsibility in our jurisdiction?
Absolutely. We've got to model the behaviour that one would expect of human beings, which sometimes we do well and sometimes we don't. And I absolutely think we should be having a long game view of the interactions that we're having with the families that we're working with. What's the long-term impact of what's happening right now? And I don't think that happens enough. I think there needs to be, as a person that spends 90% of her time at the moment as an ICL in parenting matters, there needs to be a longer-term view, because the role of a parent doesn't suddenly stop 2 years down the track. It certainly doesn't stop when kids are 18. And the impact of what's happening in this moment will be long-lasting. So all of those things. And that's that experience piece for me. It's coming back. So you're talking, I think, really around education. How do we educate people? None of us are taught to be parents. We learn from our own lived experiences, from watching other people. And it's often when families intersect with the family law system, it's the first time that someone's saying, oh, that may not be the best way of managing that. Did you know about this? And I love that we become the experts in that. That's sort of hilarious. But that whole piece, a much bigger question and thought process, I think, about how we help people is what I think will make for successful family law professionals moving forward.
And I think that's at the end of the day, that's what we want to be, right?
You wouldn't be practicing in this area if you didn't.
That's true.
You would have done 6 months and gone, no.
See you later. Bye.
Yeah, I know. And then, you know, word on the street, this is what that lawyer did to me. I just think, you know, it's super important. But can I just say, having talked to you today, I kind of feel like this has been a bit of a well-being exercise, Clarissa. Like, you know, we've created some space and had an opportunity to talk about these things. It's been really nice just hearing your thoughts about some of this stuff. I, you know, am just super impressed by what you're doing in terms of the family law space and also in terms of well-being and practice generally. So thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Clarissa. Sign us up for the next retreat. We'll be there.
Yeah, totally. Hopefully in person, like, you know,
hopefully I never have to do an online retreat again in my life.
Right. Thanks, bye.
See you soon. Bye.
You've been listening to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend. To find out more about your hosts and what they do, visit chamberlains.com.au. And now, here's the bit the boss insisted we say. The information in this podcast is for general educational purposes only. None of the content should be considered legal advice. Please don't make decisions based on the information in this podcast without seeking professional legal advice of your own. For more information, visit chamberlains.com.au.